You may recognise that music. It was a theme tune to a series of conversations several years ago here on RN between Clive James and the late poet Peter Porter. Clive James has made a career as a dry, droll commentator on all things cultural, both on TV and in print. Who can forget his description of Arnold Schwarzenegger in his bodybuilding days as looking like a brown condom full of walnuts? But he's also a poet, an essayist, a novelist, and has written several memoirs. In 2010, he was diagnosed with leukemia. And over the past 5 years, there have been several announcements that he was nearing the end. I met up with him in England, in his house in Cambridge, and I'm glad to tell you that he's still here. And, as he explains in the following interview, he's writing more than ever and says that death has been one of his greatest inspirations. Well, it's lovely to meet you, Clive. And first of all, can I say how well you are looking?
I'm amazingly fit-looking for someone who isn't. It's really because a wonderful new drug has just come online to deal with my leukemia. It won't make it go away, but it holds it back. And so I'm not in a feeling of total exhaustion anymore. I haven't got half of the energy I used to have, but what energy I've got I use much better, and I get quite a lot done, and that makes me happy. And so I have the smiling face, which your radio audience cannot see, but you can see the way my cheeks perk up.
Well, it's a smiling face in your Cambridge house, which is surrounded by books. And yes, for people who've read your latest readings, they feel this is an extra character in the book, and then also your poetry notebook. You live through your books. It's been amazing how you've managed to write so much since you were diagnosed with leukemia in 2010. It's more prolific than most people who haven't got a life-threatening illness.
Well, let me first of all congratulate you on spotting the fact that this room, this surroundings of mine, the book-filled surroundings, are actually a character. I love putting it into my writings. I like putting the thrill of reading and writing into my writing for the benefit of the next generation. And I'm glad to get these late writings done. They're surprising even me, which is always a good sign. Yeah, very good sign if you don't bore yourself. And I'm finding all kinds of things to say about the condition I'm in, which is not just being ill, but being quite old. The condition is I've lived a full life. I should be grateful for it. I'm extremely grateful for it. And I'm trying to get all that down and sort of get back to square one, get it back to the sheer thrill of being a writer. I always got a kick out of it. I used to buy 10 copies of the Sydney Morning Herald whenever I was in it. Now nobody buys a copy of the Sydney Morning Herald, I'm told.
You've probably just given them a really good circulation idea. They'll be commissioning you any moment now.
Everyone should buy 10 copies, yes. You've got to laugh. Laughing is essential in these circumstances, I think. You've got to count your blessings. It's a terrific blessing to have lived so long, to have got so sick, and I deserved to get sick. I had abused my body to such an extent. And to be granted this extra lease of life is a great blessing. And as I keep on saying, because I don't want anyone to mistake me, I do have a version of this that doesn't hurt.
When you were diagnosed, you were also you also started writing poetry about your condition, and Sentence to Life has been a huge bestseller. I went into Waterstone's bookshop here in Cambridge, and it was piled high, and your notebook, your poetry notebook, was piled high and signed by the author, stickers on it. And you have become the celebrity of the slow death, haven't you?
Yes, the bookshops are full of my books. It's every writer's dream for that to happen. And certainly it's every poet's dream. It doesn't usually happen to poetry, to have a best-selling poetry book. And I'm having a wonderful time. And it's at the right end of your life. It's very dangerous when all this kind of thing happens to you when you're very young. It spoils you and it won't come again, and people tend to get bitter. But I'm just about ready. After 75 years, I'm almost mature enough to handle it. Yeah, and you've spotted it. I'm having a great time.
Well, it's interesting you talk about being young, because I was looking at your early work and I was, you know, reading up on your Sydney childhood. And then I was thinking about poets and late style, and how people talk about the late style of a writer. And most writers wouldn't have wouldn't know if they were in their late style because they wouldn't know when they were about to pop their clogs. But you've had 5 years of self-conscious late style. Are you thinking a lot about how you're writing?
Some people, I name no names, I think are getting the impression that I've kept this dying bit going a bit too long. And they're getting, as my friend PJ O'Rourke once warned me, you've got to soft pedal this death door stuff, Clive. People are going to get impatient. I never forgot him saying that. He's a very funny guy. And it didn't occur to me that that would happen. I should have been dead 3 or 4 times since 2010. And I got lucky with the medical technology. And maybe I've got a fairly strong constitution anyway underneath all the damage. But it does raise a problem, as happened last year. In summer of last year, was it? I wrote a poem about the coming autumn, and I talked about how my Japanese maple tree, which is planted in my garden by my daughter, was going to burst into flame, and I hoped I would live to see that, and then that would be the end. Well, it did burst into flame, and guess what? It wasn't the end. I'm still here, and unless I'm careful, it'll happen again quite soon, because autumn is coming again. It can be a little embarrassing when you make promises to drop off the twig and then don't, so I'm learning not to. I might linger a little while, and if I do, I'll write about that. I'm having a lot of fun doing that, and also it's a sort of duty to sum up and to make my apologies where I should and to generally be grateful for life. And actually, I've got a lot of themes, but I try to put them into my work. I'm putting them into my work better than I could say them here. I'm reasonably good at talking off the cuff, but nobody's that good. If you're going to say profound stuff about life and death, you better say it on paper. That's what writing's for.
At your lowest, and I know we've been a bit jokey about how long you've lived in the shadow of death, but you have been in the shadow of death, and you have had to deal with tying up emotional loose ends. You've had a separation from your wife and a rapprochement with your wife, and there have been, you know, very public admissions of guilt and sorrow. And do you feel that you've come through that into a period of grace, however long you do live?
Yeah, I hasten to say that my apologies were made to my wife and my family, and that's as far as it goes. I don't want to go on apologizing in public, except to the extent that I put it into my work. It's really, if you look carefully at my poems, which I'm sure you have, you'll see that that's what some of my poems are about. They're about repentance and apology and the sense of tragedy that one, although quite intelligent, wasn't smart enough to behave better earlier. That's one of my subjects. And the danger being a writer is that you relish it. You screw up and then you think, hurrah, now I've got something new to write about, screwing up. Writers do that. That's why they're very untrustworthy and why a decent woman should never marry a male writer. I don't know if it works the other way around, but you have to be very careful of male writers.
So you do things in order to have subject matter to write about. And presumably also, as you're a writer and all writers are unscrupulous, you take other people's ideas or their anecdotes and somehow they appear in your own work.
I think you take everything. I think you're influenced by everything that happens. And writers, on the whole, don't have much experience away from the desk. I don't recommend behaving badly just so that you have something to write about. That'd be pretty close to hypocrisy. But I do think that as you live longer and read more, you'll find that everything that's happened to you happened long ago to other people. I'm still coming to terms with what people like Lucretius said about the tragedy of lovers, or what Ovid said about it. And I enjoy that. To the extent that I'm classically educated, that's the way I'm classically educated. I read the classic writers, and you discover lessons about yourself. And you find out, for example, that you're very lucky not to be speaking Latin. English is better. It's more flexible. And well, this answer's getting lost, but basically writers usually suffer from not enough having happened to them. But in fact, everything happens to you because you read about it.
I was listening to one of those conversations you had with the poet Peter Porter, the wonderful late poet Peter Porter, also an Australian, and one of those dialogues you had was about not being classically educated as a child and saying, you know, you met all the English public school boys mainly who all had the Latin and Greek and never remembered a thing, and you came to it late and you devoured it.
Yes.
And you get the sense, reading your work, that you have always devoured knowledge with huge relish.
There's a lot to be said for not sitting the child down too early at the adult's table. You, so you're just a kid, go and eat with the kids. And then the kid gets extremely hungry for what's going on at the adult's table. That's more or less happened with me and with Peter, I think. I loved him dearly, by the way. And we were in Melbourne one year for the Melbourne Festival, quite a while ago now. We got told that we got pushed on stage and said, get on there and talk, because there's something gone wrong with the program. And we got on there and talked. And what amazed the audience, mainly young people, wasn't so much what we said as the way we remembered poetry and recited it, because this was a generation that never remembered anything. They were seeing this for the first time. And to our great fortune, there was a marvellous ABC producer, my dear friend Jill Kitson, who's gone now, alas. She was in the audience, and the light bulb went on overhead, and she thought, if I can get this on the air, I've got something. And she did. We used to have the conversation. Me and Peter would talk in London, and Jill would produce it from Melbourne. And we did about 36 of them, I think. And I think they're lovely, and they show him so well. He was great company, Peter. Very, very learned man in the best way. It was informal. It was all off the course. He was the kind of man you should meet at university to make you realize what learning is. And I miss him still.
When you and Peter Porter had your conversations, there was such a sense of, you know, two explorers of the world who had left their, you know, suburban Australian upbringings to seek the bigger world, but still had a deep and abiding love for home. And I was just reading that poem of yours, Go Back to the Opal Sunset, and it's the sort of poem that if you're an expat in London, in a rainy London, and you read it, you probably just have to get on the tube to Heathrow immediately.
You almost got me in tears now. You're not going to be able to stop me reading a stanza. I'll just read through the first stanza. Go back to the opal sunset, where the wine cost peanuts and the avocado mousse is thick and strong as cream from a jade cow. Before the passion fruit shrinks on the vine, go back to where the heat turns your limbs loose. You've worked your heart out and need no excuse. Knock out your two tall tent pegs and go now. It's England, April, and it's pissing down. And there's more of that. That line is meant to trigger the big reflex. Get me back there to the beach. The truth is, I never stop writing about Australia. And in my recent work, which is all saying goodbye, my mind keeps going back to the Australian landscape, especially to Sydney. Because the great joke between me and Peter was that Peter thought, as a Brisbane boy, he was deprived at not being brought up and educated in the big smoke, Sydney. And then we both came to Europe. And it was a big adventure. I'm not so sure that it has to be done anymore. If I would been born since in Australia, the temptation would have been not to travel abroad, because Australia's got everything now. But on the other hand, I think it's wise to come abroad just to see that the rest of the world is not like Australia. They are different places, as you know. You live in both.
I do indeed, and they're both very similar and yet starkly different. Do you think, though, that I grew up overseas as well, so England, to me, was a rather fabulous place with, you know, that was filtered through Enid Blyton and Biggles and, you know, fifth form at St Clair's, and this sort of hyper-reality of Englishness that didn't actually really fit the bill. Did you also have this idea of England that, you know, didn't actually correspond to reality?
Yeah, I grew up reading The Wizard and The Rover, which were brought out from the old country. My mother used to give them to me. And I had an idea of English public school boys running around and having adventures and meeting Billy Bunter. And it turned out not to be like that. But it also turned out to be very real and interesting and very complex. I my own theory of the big trip that we made is that it didn't really work unless you went to the, let's say it was England, and were poor there. The key element was to get there and be poor, to be a poor student. So it wasn't just a tourist trip, it was a new commitment. And I was very poor in London. In fact, I was in real trouble in the early 60s. And if I hadn't fluked my way into Cambridge, I would have had to retire defeated. But I got to know Britain quite well. But I'm still finding out it's extremely complex society. And more interesting now, I think, in its post-imperial phase than it was when it was ruling the world. I could go on about this, and I might write a book about this very subject. I have its idea for a huge book. What's crazy about this is I haven't got time to write a huge book, but I want to write a companion volume to a book I once wrote called Cultural Amnesia. I want to do volume two. I don't know what it's called yet, but that would be one of the themes I tackle. I like to tackle all the themes before I croak. You can't, of course, but it's nice to have the urge to.
So what would volume two of Cultural Amnesia be concentrating on?
It would be concentrating on that, on the shape of the world, on the new alignment in world politics between, what, as I see it, Western civilization and everything that wants to defeat it, for quite understandable reasons. But I think we have to provide the young of the West with a vocabulary with which to arm themselves against the quite frightening prospect that the people running at them and wanting to destroy them are actually quite well armoured intellectually. In fact, they're even better armoured because they know exactly what they're doing, and we don't. And you have to convince our young that the fact that we don't know exactly what we're doing is the virtue of Western civilization. You see the paradox. It's where we want to live. It's very hard to defend.
And that the tolerant society has to tolerate intolerance, and that can be its destruction.
It has to tolerate intolerance, it turns out, up to a point. And where that line is drawn and how you draw it is probably one of the big questions facing us today. But there are many other questions too. If Australia is the promised land, and I think it is there such a thing as the ideal democracy producing a class of people, let's call it the intelligentsia, that doesn't quite understand how it works because it doesn't have to? Yes, there's another problem there, you see.
You've been a bit scathing about the Australian intelligentsia.
I'm stirring the possum. My dear friend Jim McClelland is gone now. But Jim used to have that expression, stirring the possum. In fact, he called one of his marvellous books, Stirring the Possum. No, all I'm doing is stirring the possum. For one thing, I'm not there. I don't know enough about it. I'm here. But this thing that I'm pointing at, which you can't see out there in Radioland, is my computer. And it keeps me in touch with Australia in a way that I never was for decades. So I follow Australian politics. And it's a terrific spectacle. It's great.
Now, as I was saying, in the last few years, you've brought out two books of poetry, the Poetry Notebook. You have translated Dante and changed the whole rhyming scheme of Dante in the process. And now you've brought out this slim volume, Latest Readings, which just where you talk about the books that you have revisited. What are the books that you've picked that remain your favourites?
Well, Shakespeare comes first. And always was, even though Dante was a big man in my life, and of course the man in my wife's life, and I've been saturated with Dante for 45 years now, more.
Your wife is a great Dante scholar, isn't
yeah,
she?
I forgot to say that, yeah, and she is a great Dante scholar. Great is the right word. And she taught me to admire his poetry at a very deep level, to the extent that eventually I translated it. But Shakespeare still comes first, if there is such a thing as rankings. It's not a hit parade, but it's sometimes fun to pretend that it is. And so Shakespeare's at number one always, and I never stop reading him. And then there's everybody else, and I do try and read everybody that counts. But it's a big task, and you can't keep up with it all. And there's a mechanism in the mind called forgetting, which is almost as interesting as remembering. One of the themes of this little book, Latest Readings, is that I go back to things like Anthony Powell's Dance to the Music of Time sequence, or to Evelyn Waugh's Sword of Honor, and I find out things that I've forgotten. Conrad's novels, I find out things I'd never realized. And that's as important to me in this book as discovering someone, as I discovered Olivia Manning and her great trilogies about the Levant and the Balkans. What a writer she was. But there's not that many discoveries like that in this book for a simple reason. I've been alive a long time and I've discovered them all. There weren't many left to discover. What they were, what there was left to do was to reassess in the light of the life I had lived. If you lived right through this the second half of the last century and on into this one, Conrad looks better and better, because Conrad's novels really faced the big issue of the idiotic autocracy versus the idiotic revolution, the big conflict of the 20th century. He guessed it all. He was way ahead. But that's the kind of reassessment you can only make after you've lived.
Getting ill must have influenced what you decided to read.
Not really. I was reading a lot anyway, and somebody at Yale University heard about this and had the notion of inviting me to do a notebook about it. So I actually went on reading exactly what I felt like, and I made that the story. Why I was reading something again, why I was reading something frivolous instead of something profound, and so on. It's part of the story, and I hope I made it reasonably entertaining. It's a stocking filler, actually, and it looks like it might last all the way to Christmas, which is when stockings happen. And it's a nice format, and I'm actually doing another one in the same format for Yale. It's going to be about binge-watching TV box sets, and I've only just started it, so I can't say much about it because it hasn't yet finalized itself in my mind, or even begun, really.
I know it's going to feature the Game of Thrones, isn't it?
Oh, sure. It ends with Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is the peak. My younger daughter thinks I should call the book Band of Thrones, because it starts with Band of Brothers and ends with Game of Thrones. I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking of titles. It's always a good sign when you start thinking about the title. I'll probably get it done. But there's a big book coming up in spring. I hope I'm here to see that one. It's already completed. It's my collected poems. Picador is going to do my collected poems.
You were talking in praise of the slim volume. Do you think you'll enjoy picking up a hefty tome of your verse?
It's luckily not as hefty as it might have been, because with the aid of my great editor at Picador, Don Patterson, we've managed to leave a few poems out. He's very good at that. It's very hard, usually, for an editor-in-chief to persuade a poet that some of his poems might be dispensable, less than immortal. And usually I decide myself whether a poem can be taken out, as it were, but often it takes a few decades to get to that point. Until then, you think that everything you've written is marvellous. Don is very good at saying, and keeps on saying, the real secret of a collected poem is it mustn't be too big, or it gets defeated by its own dimensions. But it'll be a pretty hefty book.
What are your favourite poems? Because I'd love you to read another poem.
I would love to.
And it could be from, you know, we don't have to go to your latest collection by any means. It can be from any period of your writing.
I think a lot of poems are the best thing I ever did. Magic Wheel is one of them. Was published by my American publishers, Norton, and then Picador republished it here very kindly. And there's got a poem in it which I'm fond of because, strangely enough, it's about the past, which shouldn't be the past. It's about space travel, about a spaceship called Genesis, which headed off into space, I forget in what year, to do experiments, collect samples. And Genesis was the kind of spaceship that I think we aren't sending very often anymore. In many ways, the space era is over for now, so for me it's looking back. But it will come again. I'm rather sorry I'm missing out on all that. I'd like to be alive for the first Mars flight. And I love the moon flights. I love the astronauts.
You could volunteer for the Mars flight. This could be the great gesture.
I did volunteer for the space shuttle. I tried to persuade one of the magazines to get me trained and send me up. And they took one look at me and said, well, you're going to have to lose 50 pounds and indeed 50 years. It was a wild dream, but it was a dream. I love the whole idea of space. I'm the kind of person who actually will buy the DVD of that Gravity movie with Clooney. The Genesis wafers. Genesis had an experiment on board to collect particles sent from the sun. The Genesis wafers. Genesis carried wafers in her hold to catch the particles sent from the sun. Diamond, sapphire, gold were those fine webs, as if by spiders spun, beside whom specks of dust would weigh a ton. A million miles from Earth, in the deep cold, the particles collected in the skeins, diamond, sapphire, gold, they flowered like tiny salt pans in the rains, fresh tablecloths distressed with coffee stains. Back in the lab, the altered wafers told a story of how poetry is born. Diamond, sapphire, gold, serenities invaded by stuff torn from the incandescent storm that powers the dawn. I've got two reasons for being pleased about that poem. I think it's got the quietness of the spaceship, and it's also got an Australian reference, because the salt pan flowering in the rains, of course, that comes from my childhood when I saw newsreels of Lake Eyre. After Lake Eyre flooded once a year, it would grow flowers. I never forgot it. I think that's the way early images get into your work and get into your work again, and until one day it's all over.
Do you find Australian images come more to you now that you're older, that you're in exile? Because you can't actually travel back, can you?
No, it's a great sadness to me that I really can't get to Australia. And it would take a lot of technology. I don't have enough oxygen saturation to fly without oxygen equipment. And I can't be away from Addenbrooke's hospital too long, because I have to have my immune system replaced every 3 weeks to go by ship. And so really I'm here. And I miss it, but on the other hand, my memory of Australia gets sharper and sharper all the time. And I find it quite difficult now to write a poem without an Australian image in it somewhere.
Here we are sitting at your desk, surrounded by work, and you're planning several new works. Do you feel that you've got a new lease of life now?
I think I've probably got a new lease of... I hope this doesn't sound too pretentious. I've got a new lease of talent. I wouldn't say that I had a new lease of life. I feel that I've been able to get back to the initial thrill and do it better. And that's a great feeling. And I'm very glad to have had a last phase. Never let me leave that out when I speak on air, is that I'm very, very grateful to have lived this long and to be fading away in a version of disappearance that doesn't hurt. Because if it hurt, I'm not so sure I'd be writing anything. I'm not that brave, and I wouldn't be able to concentrate. And I can concentrate now better than I ever could, because I'm not doing anything else except writing.
You will be remembered as a poet. And
I'm counting on you to do the remembering. So speak up. Yeah. Sorry, don't let me interrupt you there.
No, you know, you'll be remembered as a poet and an essayist just as much as a TV pundit.
I love hearing that because that clears away a lot of grief. Because if I had passed out much earlier, the first thing that people would have remembered was that I was on TV. And much as I loved it, I never knock being on TV. It not only paid for the groceries, I had a lot of fun. And some of the work I did, I'm quite proud of. I don't think I ever wrote anything better than my postcard programs, for example. But of course, to me, the actual essays and poetry are the most important thing. And I've had a chance in this late phase, since the year 2000 when I retired from the screen, I've had a chance to assert myself as a writer, rediscover myself, redefine myself as a writer. And I'm very, very glad for that, because it might even affect my obituaries.
Presumably people have been writing them and then updating them and then
yes.
Check out. Do you know, have friends phone you and said, I had a call the other day from, you know, so-and-so, just wanting, you know, a quote about what a marvellous chap Clive James was.
I love that. There was a great round of them about 2 years ago, because I really thought I was going to croak, and I actually I told the BBC in a radio show that I was getting near the end. It was one of those conversations where you try and look realistic, try and sound realistic. And the newspapers got hold of it before it was broadcast. And for some reason it became news, probably because I'd been on TV. And so the obituaries started rolling out, and some of them were very good. And my friend Tom Stoppard, whom I love dearly and gives me the flattering compliment of paying attention to my work, he said, these obituaries are marvellous. Don't deny this. Just lie back and enjoy it. And I kind of did for a while. And then I put out a notice saying, hey, still here. Feeling a bit mischievous. And it goes on happening, because it's bound to be right eventually.
Let's hope that you actually, you know, stay as long as possible and keep on giving us more and more marvellous books.
I'm thinking of making a career of it, you know. The dying phase, it's a new career. The trouble is that they'll all be doing it.
Clive, thanks very much indeed.
You're too nice. It's a thrill to have you.